It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret. Yesterday, U.S. officials confirmed that a video showing the beheading of an American journalist, James Foley, by a member of ISIS was authentic. Coming up, we'll hear how the president has responded and what could be next.
Protests continue to unfold in Ferguson, Missouri, where the streets are lined with heavily armored police officers and, at least for now, National Guard members. It's the result of the killing of a young, unarmed black man by a white police officer.
For some, the unrest in Missouri harkens back to clashes between the police and civil rights protesters of the 1960s. While there's a lot of attention paid to the relationship between African Americans and police departments around the country today, our next guest says there's a precedent for that in American history.
Jonathan Pollack is with us now. He's a history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and our resident Central Time historian. John, welcome back.
Hi, nice to be back.
Well, how far back do these types of conflicts go between police departments and people in cities, these riots that may have a racial component?
Well, if we're talking about African Americans in specific, then we're really looking at the era immediately after the Civil War. That as African Americans left plantations on which they had been enslaved and went to cities in search of work, there were all kinds of laws set up that sounded neutral enough, but were really designed to clamp down on the rights of African Americans and really channel them into an emerging prison system that leased people out to do essentially the same jobs they had done while enslaved. So as part of that, I mean, one of the things that kind of resonated with me as I read the news coming out of Ferguson this last week or so was the way that the law comes down to enforcement. That there are, you know, the law, so to get back to the end of the Civil War, to the 1860s and 1870s, the laws in question there were vagrancy laws that were passed. And as often the case, the law sounds logical enough. Maybe it's not a good idea to allow people to just hang out on the street with nothing to do. Maybe vagrancy is itself leads to criminal activity and so forth. But then right away, you have to ask the question, what's the definition of vagrancy? You know, if somebody's waiting in a park for somebody to come out of their office and they're going to go have something to eat, or if, you know, there are lots of reasons that people are not in constant motion in their comings and goings, at what point does pausing become vagrancy? Well, that's, you know, the call we leave to the police and so forth. We don't have elected officials out there doing that. They delegate that to people charged with policing. And vagrancy laws were almost entirely enforced against African Americans. That whites who were at liberty, who were between jobs, who even sleeping in public parks, didn't seem to get pulled in on vagrancy charges very often, where for African Americans, even who paused for short periods of time, they would be charged with vagrancy, brought in before a court, have trouble finding an attorney who'd take their case and so forth, and wind up railroaded to prison on charges of vagrancy. So I think that's an early precedent, and certainly we can go through lots more instances through the 19th and 20th century, where for me it always comes down to enforcement. When I teach about the law in my classes, you know, we tend to seize on laws as a way of structuring history because it seems neutral. It's like, oh, well, there's the law. It's right there in the book. It's not an idea. It's not a political platform. It's the law. It got passed. But then we always have to ask ourselves, how do the laws get enforced? Who gets caught? Who doesn't? What are the patterns in that? And also at the same time, we have to expect there's going to be some variation. We can't have, you know, the idea of perfect enforcement is kind of scary. I know even for things as innocuous as lights at intersections, people will say, oh, well, that's a huge invasion. I can't believe that the city is going to have lights at intersections determining when people run a red light. And that's really unfair and so forth. Well, that's perfect enforcement. That doesn't leave it then in the hands of when there's a police officer out there or the police officer is figuring out who to pull over for running a light and not. And people bristle at that. So it's this fascinating conundrum that the law is flexible. And that can definitely work against people. And at the same time, perfect enforcement also has its drawbacks.
And you mentioned the Civil War era. To dig into that a little bit, when is the first event that stands out in your mind as a time when civil unrest unfolded as a result of what might seem like unfair enforcement?
Well, one of them would be even a little earlier. The New York draft riots are a big part of that. So in 1863, during the Civil War, Irish immigrants to the United States were being drafted or were being paid to enlist, were being paid to take someone else's place. And there was a great deal of resentment about this, that as earlier Irish immigrants had gone and fought the Civil War and found out, no, this is really a pretty horrible thing, they came to associate by 1863 and 1864. Also, it was very clear that one of the major issues in the war was ending slavery and therefore civil rights. And so whites who were going off to fight this war kind of turned on blacks in their neighborhoods and said, wait, we don't want to be fighting this war for you. Well, at the same time, African Americans had just won the right to actually enlist and fight. Blacks had been kind of fighting for this, and the U.S. military had kept them at arm's length and prevented them from doing so. So there were large numbers of black men of draftable age in their late teens and early 20s around, white men not as much, and so they turned on them. And I'd say that was kind of an issue of what seemed like selective enforcement, that whites were being forced to serve, blacks were not, and therefore white mobs were angry and burned down black-owned businesses, chased blacks in the street, attacked homes, and so forth. That's often, if we look more recently, if we jump forward 100 years, and we look at the conflicts of the 1960s, if we look at Detroit in 1967, if we look at Watts in Los Angeles, if we look at the long hot summers, or what people call them, of the 1960s, that there also it comes down to selective enforcement, that oftentimes the incident that seems to have sparked it after after destruction, after the National Guard was called in and left and people took time to kind of take inventory and take stock and figure what was going on, it came down to either an aggressive traffic stop or even the rumor of an aggressive traffic stop, that tensions around this idea of selective enforcement had become so great that people were receptive to sort of second and third hand stories that maybe overemphasize the details of what actually happens at a particular arrest. They were prepared to believe it, that nothing shocked them, that seemed entirely possible, and they were ready to believe the worst. So that's, again, why a lot of the commentators to go forward now to Ferguson, many of the commentators looking at it have talked about they've talked about the climate so much that some people are just saying, well, how do we just fix this problem and so forth? And other others just say, well, it's Ferguson is the surface. And there are lots of potential Fergusons out there. There are lots of cities where the same kind of selective enforcement goes on. And so the same kind of pressure builds up. And there's just the same information exchanged in among communities, that they see the police as an occupying presence. They're willing to believe the worst. And so when something happens, boom, it's the worst possible circumstance. And they're extremely angry about it. And there's, the resolution of one case might or might not end up making a huge difference.
Well, one strand of this that analysts like David Brooks have been talking about is the problem of perhaps a lack of diversity in Ferguson's police force. The idea that there's a white police force enforcing an African-American community being an inherent setup for problems, is that a strand that goes back in history?
That definitely is, yeah. And there are several, and again, this is a live issue that's gone back and forth. So, for starters, when we look at policing, and for some reason I'm talking about the 19th century today, so okay, we'll go back there again. when we talk about the beginnings of metropolitan police departments in the U.S., so when we talk about the 19th century, police work was a niche. It was an economic niche like anything else. So when people moved to a city, they'd find people they knew who could get them a job doing something, whatever that was. And so in the case of African Americans, by the time African Americans started settling in cities in large numbers, there were very few blacks who had been in cities who had gotten on police forces. You know, of course, in the 19th century, there's no law whatsoever about hiring across to ensure an ethno-racially diverse police force. It's completely niche hiring. It's completely who you know gets you the job. So when we talk about African Americans and urban history, it's pretty much a straight trajectory through the 19th century into like the 1970s, where black populations became, when we talk about African American communities, they're increasingly urban communities. And so they're coming into cities where police departments are historically places where no blacks worked. Again, much of that was due to racist attitudes against blacks, belief that blacks were unfit for police work and so forth. And beyond that, the close networks within families, within ethnic groups and so forth, within neighborhoods that ensured that people who knew police officers became police officers. So that's one aspect of it. One thing that cities have done as they've diversified is they've passed laws to that require police officers to live in the communities they police. There was a commentator I read who talked about that, who used, I think he's based in Platteville, and he talked about Platteville as a point. It's like, well, everybody lives in Platteville, and they know the police officers. And it's like, well, okay, a couple of things. Number one, if there's no requirement that police officers have to work there, then the community they police becomes where they go to do their job. They're not tied into it. They don't necessarily know, you know, who are the people who, you know, who glare at them but really are not going to, you know, be serious criminals, and who is going to look menacing and actually is. They're not going to have that kind of neighborhood knowledge that you get of, I mean, if you think about like the neighborhood you live in versus the neighborhoods you drive to get to work, there's a big difference. You know, you can drive past someplace every day and you can watch the construction go up. You can watch stores go in and out of business and so forth, but you don't really know the people there. You've never been inside that store. You've never been into that restaurant or bar. But the restaurants and bars in your neighborhood and the stores in your neighborhood, you totally know them. They know you. So as police officers, when they moved out of cities, this is kind of a big issue that came up. If they're never in the city, they don't know it. They're not connected to it. So they're residency laws. But then many police officers said, we don't want to live in the city. You know, this is something that's just being, that's still being, I think, still hashed out in Milwaukee currently. So it's not clear. One of the things I've been looking for and haven't found is, what's the story in Ferguson? Do police officers have to live there? That would kind of make a difference. And even in a big city, you know, St. Louis, Milwaukee, when we look at suburban areas also, cities are, if we look at them from like a 20,000-foot vantage point, they're very diverse. We can see lots of different populations there and so on. But when we're actually on a ground level, many American cities, and St. Louis is a prime example, are extremely segregated. So even if police officers lived, you know, had to live in Ferguson, chances are they weren't living in the neighborhood, you know, the neighborhoods closer
where Michael Brown was,
the street that he was shot on, that was this one sort of largely black enclave in what otherwise is a fairly integrated city.
We're talking right now with Jonathan Pollock of Madison College about the difficult relationship between the police and African-Americans throughout U.S. history.
And you can join the conversation. Do you have thoughts or questions about race riots or other racially charged civil unrest and police violence in American history? What do you think it would take to smooth things out in the future? You can call in with your thoughts and questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. We continue our conversation with Central Times resident historian John Pollock, looking at the history of race, police, and tension in American cities in the light of events in Ferguson, Missouri.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question or a comment about the history we're talking about? Why have we seen these problems repeatedly cycle through different generations, and how can we move past them? 800-642-1234 is our number. You can also send your email to talk@wpr.org.
In 1968, that was a year that saw many major urban riots in several cities across the country. What happened there?
Whoa. Wow. Okay, that's a big question.
I think many of them were tethered specifically to the assassination of Martin Luther King.
Well, I mean, I think the assassination of Martin Luther King is another example of something I referenced earlier very quickly, so I'll go back to it, that in many cases, when we're talking about a big conflict in an urban area, there are things that are going on underneath the surface long before that. So in many cities that saw a great deal of destruction and anger after King was assassinated, there had been earlier earlier incidences of police brutality in the city. There were areas where the police already, you know, as cities grew to the point that you could no longer police a big city like Detroit or Los Angeles or Chicago on foot, and police officers were stationed in cars. That made a big difference because, again, when you're driving around in a car, you don't interact with people as much. Mm-hmm. You don't really talk to people on the sidewalks unless you stop your car and get out and so forth. So there was a rising amount of hostility during that time. The policing strategies that came out in the 1960s, many of them talked about, started using more kind of military language, military analogies about surveying territory and so forth. And as a result, there were more aggressive encounters. There were more instances of police treating suspects in a brutal fashion. So in cities that saw uprisings after Martin Luther King was assassinated, I think that came in because King was always a force, and especially by the late 60s, For many people, the earlier semi-radical nature of his message was kind of gone, and King was sort of he was the old style. You know, he was it's nonviolent. We're going to put on a show of soul force. We're going to show that we have we are stronger than the people who are trying to oppress us, and we're not going to fight. And a lot of people found that kind of unsatisfactory and so forth. And King came across as one of the most moderate leaders by the time he was assassinated. But then he was assassinated. And so at that point, people were kind of saying, oh, come on, that guy of all people, that he was the one assassinated, you know, how deep is the racism in America in 1968? So very long way of getting around to that question, which, to be fair, it was a really big question.
I'm sorry.
But that's where I think it came from.
Well, let's get our callers in on this right now. We've got Mikkel joining us in Eau Claire. Hi, Mikkel.
Hello. How are you guys today?
Doing well. What do you think?
Well, I'm thinking at this point, basically what I've experienced in my life is that racism has been put behind closed doors. And I've lived all over the country pretty much, and I've seen and witnessed a lot of white people expressing their racism towards African Americans. And overall, I think what's going on is it's become something that is cliche, that is not talked about, that is unwritten, that is unseen, and it still exists very prevalently. And it's not only throughout the South, in the West, in California, in the South, in Florida, in the East, in New York, but it's also in the Midwest and in the North. It's everywhere. And you talk about high-ranking officials, judges, police officers. They're all known to be racists in their own homes. And this is the truth.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your experience and your thoughts, Mikkel. What about that, Jonathan? As racism becomes a taboo topic more and more in society, it's obviously illegal. There, we have hate crimes for this sort of thing. Do people just continue to practice racism inside their homes?
I think Mikkel really nailed it. I think that comment was spot on. One of the things I find really fascinating, and it's been in the last few years, I've really thought about this quite a bit. It's the phrase, "I'm not racist." You know, like you've got the Sterling thing where he tells his girlfriend not to bring her black friends into a basketball arena of 20,000 people. And, you know, what's his response to that? I'm not racist. You know, so Mikkel is absolutely right that racism is hidden. I mean, granted, in things like the Sterling case and in Ferguson, the comments that are coming out of there. No, it's an open display, but people won't talk about it. And but at the same time, as the caller also pointed out, yes, absolutely, racism is still there. And in a lot of ways, I think that makes, when we talk about this kind of tension that's in the background, that's hard to identify, that's hard to pinpoint, but I think is definitely in the background of what we're seeing in Ferguson. When we talk about this tension and we ask ourselves, where does this tension come from? Well, tension always comes up when you hold things back. You know, whenever you have you're in a work situation where you dislike the people you work with for some reason, but you can't say anything about it, you hold that in you're tense. And you don't despise them any less. You know, it's still, but it becomes an extremely tense situation. And when we talk about racism, no, it's not gone. It's still there. But people are not talking about it publicly. At the same time, if we say, oh, well, great, then everybody should just be like straight out racist and so forth. No, that would also be a terrible idea. As you pointed out, Veronica, we have laws against this and for good reason. But nonetheless, that tension is what we all have to cope with. And I think our last caller put it very well.
And there are some who allege that coming out of the Ferguson situation that we're creating a conversation about race that isn't there. And at the same time, we're seeing people compare what's happening in Ferguson with images of what was happening in the 1960s with the Civil Rights Act. Is that a fair comparison?
So I think I would say second yes, first no. The images are really compelling. I think there's a lot of resonance there. I think a lot of those wounds have not healed. That in as much as people talked a few years ago about entering a post-racial phase in the United States, I'd say nope, that hasn't happened. And at the same time, I'm also, you know, and it's kind of part of a piece with the I'm not racist thing I talked about a minute ago. The idea that the way to solve racism is not to talk about it. I mean, I think this is, you know, it's an interesting idea as an educator, as somebody who likes to get people to try new things and learn new stuff. It's something that really goes against just kind of how I'm put together, that I'm kind of all about new experience. But that definitely is an idea that's out there that people say, well, we just should shut up about it and it'll go away. It would be an interesting social experiment to do. I mean, again, based on the caller's experiences, I don't think it would actually work. But yeah, that definitely is an idea that's out there.
Well, Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate your time.
Okay. Thanks for bringing me in again.
That was Jonathan Pollock, history instructor at Madison Area Technical College and resident historian here at Central Time.